whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-ups are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
I'm Akhil Bilgrami, and I teach philosophy at Columbia University. I also teach courses in the political science department, mostly on rationality and politics. And my work has been in philosophy of language and mind. And more recently, I've also added to my repertory of interests political philosophy and the moral psychology of politics.
I'm going to start by asking you a question about the inspiration for the podcast, Iris Murdoch. I believe you met Iris Murdoch. Could you say something about the experience of meeting her and what she was like?
Sure. You know, several years ago, when I was running the Humanities Center at Columbia, I invited her and John Bailey to come in and speak, and they both spoke. And I spent some time with them over a day or two. I particularly remember a very long evening, not long in the sense of experienced as long, but it was several hours with them, and very enjoyable discussions, very serious discussions about literature and psychology and philosophy, and they were both very good company.
So what did she talk about? What was the topic she was presenting on?
You know, she presented, I had asked her to spell out her distinction between the role of the will in moral thought and moral experience, and the role of cognition and intellect and of attentiveness, because those are the things that I had sort of pounced on when I had read some of the work, mostly Sovereignty of Good, the essays there. And she was very happy to do that. She spoke on that. And if I remember, we really pretty much continued that conversation. And we spoke a lot about particular novels. And I think for some reason we fastened on the Russians, because John Bailey had maybe talked about Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. And, you know, I'm a great admirer of Dostoevsky and Brothers Karamazov in particular. So the discussion revolved around Dostoevsky. And I think we all agreed that Dostoevsky was particularly interesting because he was a very existentialist thinker and writer. And so the will obviously played a great role in his thinking about life and experience. But my own view was that, like others in the Slavophil tradition that had influenced him, he was a sort of a religiously based moral realist. And so the other side of Murdoch's interests, which is attention to the good and the cognition of the good, the contemplation and of the good, were also very much present in Dostoevsky, especially in the character Ivan.
Well, I'm going to ask you later on about works of art and philosophy, so we may continue this conversation or related conversation in that context, but I'm going to start with a question I always start with, inspired by Murdoch, who begins the podcast telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but who also wrote, to do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth. So would you say your temperament influences your philosophy? And if so, how?
You know, Karen, I think that if you take in the fact that temperament itself is a changeable thing, that, you know, if you don't think of temperament as given by one's genetic endowment, as it were, but as being shaped by a lot of different things that one undergoes through the normal development of a life from youth to adulthood and onwards, I suspect my temperament itself has been quite malleable and changed given the context in which I found myself. I came to philosophy quite late, you know. My first degree was in English literature from a college in Bombay. And then I got the scholarship to go to England and go to Oxford, and I was going to do English. And in fact, my choices were English or to go to RADA and become a theatrical actor. And it's only when I landed up in Oxford that I actually switched to philosophy, partly because I had friends who got me very interested in philosophical topics. And Donald Davidson and Michael Dummett were giving their seminar at that time, and Gareth Evans was a very charismatic and interesting figure. So I got very quickly seduced into philosophy and sort of defected. And I suspect my temperament completely changed when I realized I didn't know much philosophy and I had to study it very hard. And it shaped my temperament to study philosophy. And it's only recently that I've begun to think of philosophy in slightly more loose and you know, going beyond the silos of analytic philosophy to include an interest in not just political philosophy, but politics and political economy. So I suspect, in a way, I'm recovering my temperament from a much earlier period before I first did philosophy and did it quite fiercely and wrote my first two books in philosophy of language and mind. And now I write about that, but I also bring it into political philosophy. And as I said, the study of politics.
Can I ask about the change in temperament? It's very interesting to think of not your temperament shaping philosophy, but philosophy shaping your temperament. Can you say something about what the shift in temperament was between the sort of pre-philosophy interest in English literature and afterwards?
You know, when I was doing philosophy of language and mind, I studied in Chicago and I wrote a dissertation with Davidson. And even in Oxford, when I was really picking up stuff that was very foreign to me, I pretty much began to think that philosophy was just not continuous with life. It was an abstraction from life. You really literally had to not think about living and really think about ideas in an abstracted way. And so I was learning philosophy of language, philosophical logic, philosophy of mind, and my teachers, I mean, Davidson and others, were I think, just not particularly interested in literature and so on. They thought of it in rather remote ways. So in that sense, philosophy shaped my temperament. I just lost the conviction that I unselfconsciously had, and which I think I've regained now, which is that philosophy ought to be continuous with living a life. And I think that's very much part of what Wittgenstein was trying to say when he thought forms of life shaped what was conspicuously in the foreground in more articulated ways. And I think that's right. And my temperament has always thought so. But there was a long period in which I think I didn't do things that way.
That's really interesting. I mean, you may have already given one sort of answer to the question I'm about to ask, but I'm going to ask the question and see where it goes. This is question two. Have you changed your mind about a major philosophical issue? And if so, how?
Yeah, I think that is surely true of me, that I used to think that politics was just a matter of making material transformations in society. You know, when I say I came to philosophy late, that's absolutely true. For 6 years, I was a member of a communist party and its youth wing in India from my mid-teens till I left for England. And I actually, in a fit of sentimentality, went back to India and joined the communists again after Oxford, before coming to America. And so I spent a lot of time away from philosophy. I came to it late. And my thinking about politics was Marxist, more or less. And you know, I was all focused on the activism and on Marxist ideas of a material transformation of society. I now think of politics much more in moral psychological terms. And that's a major change in my thinking. I mean, I really do think that we need a conception of preferences or desires that are in politics and which are very important to understand in a deeply philosophical way, because we try and change people's minds. And if there's going to be deliberative democracy, if you're going to seek to change people's minds, you've got to find inconsistencies and tensions in their views and exploit them to change their minds. All this is very important for politics. And so my work has recently been in trying to understand if there's a notion of coherence amongst desires and preferences. You know, people don't go around contradicting themselves. So it's not just inconsistency that we look at. We look at tensions in their views. And we don't have any clear doctrinal way of codifying even come close to codifying or understanding what a notion of coherence is or lack of coherence is, over and above consistency and inconsistency in our preferences. And I've been trying to work on that, and I think it makes a huge difference to politics, because if people have internal tensions in their preferences, then you can work on that to seek revisions in people, and deliberative democracy should be all about that.
Could you say something about how that shift happened, the shift from this more materialist understanding of politics to one that's guided by moral psychology? Was there a particular author or a particular moment in which that changed for you, or was it kind of a gradual evolution?
Well, it changed for me mostly because of conversations I had with Bernard Williams after I'd read Internal and External Reasons, that paper of his. Maybe I should tell you very quickly what I have in mind.
Sure.
You see, if you take the following pair of preferences. So I desire to do philosophy, and I desire to have tea in the morning when I get up. That's one pair. Another pair is I desire to do philosophy, and I desire to please my father. Now, just as a bit of biography, my father was an intellectual. He would have liked me to become a philosopher. All right, so all that's in the background. So now, the first pair has nothing to do with each other. I have both those desires, but they're just merely consistent. They're both implementable by me, which is what consistency in desires means. The second pair have something to do with each other in my case, in my moral psychology. I desire to do philosophy, and I desire to please my father. But now, though they have something to do with each other, it isn't the usual Humean idea that the relationship between them is one of means end. I don't desire to do philosophy in order to fulfill the desire to please my father. It's just not like that with me. So it's not mere consistency. It's not a means-end relationship, but there's something else. They go together. They rationally reinforce each other. And that's what I'm interested in. That rational reinforcement and the lack of it, which I call tension. I think this is an extremely important thing in politics, because people don't go around being inconsistent in any straightforward way, but there's a lot of tension in their views. In this way, their preferences lack mutual reinforcement and have the opposite of it, which I suppose is a kind of dissonance or tension. And I think those are the ways in which deliberation seeks to change people's minds in the public arena. And that's been my interest. And that's a complete change from how I thought about politics.
It's interesting that there's a reflexivity there, that part of what you changed your mind about was how people's minds are changed, like what kind of processes and kinds of thinking are efficacious in changing people's perspectives. I mean, has this shift in your understanding of moral psychology, I mean, has it changed how you do philosophy itself?
Well, you know, the thing is that I don't think so, because there's no doubt that even though I write a lot about politics, I do write about politics in a very philosophical way, in an analytic philosopher's way. So in that sense, though I occasionally write op-eds for newspapers and so on when asked to, even there, I think people find it just a little too remote. It's not just ordinary political commentary. It's very much a philosopher's angle on politics.
Well, there are more questions I would love to ask you about this, but I'm going to move us on to a different topic that sort of pulls us back maybe to the earlier point in your intellectual history, although it sounds like you may have come full circle. This is question three. Is there a work of art that you love in part for its philosophical depth?
Dostoevsky's Karamazov has been very influential in my thinking for a long time, and it's partly because I think I've been fairly critical of the liberal enlightenment in my writing, and Dostoevsky's work is very much part of a tradition of romantic thought, which has been critical of, you know, just the Russian critique of Europe, of the Slavophile tradition. It's what made Azarbulin very anxious in his two concepts of liberty. I think he was really channeling the anxieties he had about the Slavophile tradition from his own background that he was reacting to. And I'm interested in critiques of the Enlightenment, of the Orthodox liberal Enlightenment. I think there's a radical Enlightenment which is shot through with Romantic thought, especially the early Marx. And so Dostoevsky has been of great influence to me. But you know, there is something which you might be interested in. I have been very fascinated by a work which came out in the 80s, late 80s, and I read it in the 90s and wrote a long review of it, but it was so long that I didn't know what to do with it, still lying in my drawers. It's a book by Shirley Hazzard called The Transit of Venus, an absolutely beautiful novel and a profound novel. And it's about a subject which I think is probably best to call higher order moral luck. It's about two women and their lives and loves, and they're feminists by instinct and by upbringing at home, but they live in a pre-feminist time. It's set in the 50s, and they have no discourse or doctrine to hang their instinctive feminism on. There's just no peg to hang it on. The discourse is not in the air. And I'm very interested in that. Partly, you know, it's biographical. My sisters, I think, of that generation, and I think of them a lot, and it's probably what moved me into this. But it's of great interest to me, generally, that what happens when you're born before your time in this way? It's sort of bad luck in a higher-order moral sense. You're conceptually unprepared for the zeitgeist you have. And I've been thinking a lot about politics and how we just don't have in our political zeitgeist the concepts and discourse to make a fundamental critique of capitalism as it currently exists. We just don't have it. We don't have the, you know, somebody, I think it was Frederick Jameson, the literary critic, who said, we can more easily imagine today the end of the world than we can imagine the end of capitalism. And I think the reason for that is because we just don't have the discourse for a fundamental critique of capitalism. We can have social democracy, we can have basically Keynesian ideas of putting constraints on capital, but actually making a fundamental critique, I don't believe we have the concepts when we are in an era of globalized finance capital. And that interests me a lot. I mean, I think a lot of the crazy contemporary populisms is because working people just have no concepts with which to make a fundamental critique. So they grab whatever crazy quasi-fascist discourse there is, promising fantastic transformations. But I do think that the flaw lies in the fact that the discursive field is something that just doesn't give us enough for the things we really need and want. And I think the politics of our time is really confronted with that. So in general, I'm very, very interested in that, what I call moral, higher order moral luck, to be in a situation where you have instincts, where you have needs in some objective sense, but the zeitgeist doesn't give you any help because there's no analysis, there's no discourse, no concept sufficient to make that critique.
Yeah, I think that's very compelling. I mean, it connects with something in Murdoch about one task of philosophy being to forge new concepts and thereby make it possible to come to moral terms with situations that we haven't been able to come to terms with. And it's a very interesting, puzzling phenomenon to be in the situation of being, as it were, conscious that one doesn't have the right concepts for the situation you're in.
Where does she say that? Is it in Sovereignty?
It's in Vision and Choice and Morality. Yeah, somewhere in Vision and Choice and Morality she says this.
Okay.
And, I mean, one thing she says there, or one thing that that's suggested by that that might also connect with literature is that it can prompt the thought that we might turn to imaginative literature as a kind of source of those new concepts. It sounds like The Transit of Venus is not about providing those concepts, it's about the dilemma of not having them. But is that something you hold out hope for, that fiction might be a place that enables the expansion of our conceptual horizons?
Well, you know, it's not just a rarefied issue of that kind. That issue is fascinating in itself. But part of the problem is, you know, a few professors might have the discourse and the concept. The point is, it's not part of the political arena.
Right.
So working people have suffered from stagnation in wages, in real wages, for ages and ages. And, you know, people like Piketty and all have written about this. And we have nothing in the political discourse for this. That's the real issue when it comes to politics. Not just that we have no discourse at all, because it's quite possible that, as Murdoch says, we might be able to shift our conceptual vocabularies sufficiently. But how do we get them into the political zeitgeist? I mean, right now, there's no political party that is electable that is further left of the Pope.
Right.
The Pope's position is about as far left as any electable position in politics anywhere in the world. And I think that's partly because even if there was a discourse, it just hasn't penetrated where it's supposed to penetrate, in the public arena.
No, I think that's right. Yeah, I feel like there are serious questions to ask about this, but there's a less serious question I want to ask you that is sort of relevant in a way, which is connected with your relationship with literature in particular, which is something you say in your, I assume that you wrote the bio that is on your webpage, that you say you defected to philosophy from literature because you found literature too hard. And I've always wanted to ask if you would elaborate on that comment about the difficulty of studying literature.
Well, it's the difficulty of studying it, you know, because I don't think, I mean, if there's any philosopher whose temperament I think I must share, it's John McDowell, whom I greatly admire. And I think he's so completely right that the very fact that you can't codify practical reason just makes it really completely continuous with literature. And I do really think that it's just not what I was setting out to do in the study of literature was something just wasn't in keeping with that. I didn't want to write boring papers, you know, which were sort of hyper-analytical in the way that some of my teachers were. I mean, you know, I admire Christopher Ricks, but it's just not my way of doing literature. I think literature is all about vision and of kinds of practical reason or the space of reasons in the non-discursive field. You know, in the field where there may not even be propositions. It could just be images or metaphors. And I think that in that sense, literature is completely continuous with philosophy for me now. And I changed my mind not because of some serious piece of internal reflection. I often change my mind just because I've read, you know, let me give you an example, Kieran. For years, even when I had stopped being a communist, there was nobody I hated more than anti-communists. I mean, I wasn't a communist, but I disliked a certain kind of person who was anti-communist. And there were many of them when I was, you know, where I was, and even in Oxford and certainly here in this country. And I just changed my views. I remember seeing a black and white movie in which there was an anti-communist who was very appealingly drawn. I can't remember it. And there was no internal cogitation on my part. I just came around to giving up this seeming prejudice on my part. Now, I don't know. I mean, can I say exactly how that happened? I don't think so. I mean, I think the way literature or films and so on, or images or metaphors affect us is simply not in that deliberative mode. It's just not discursive in that way. They just nudge us out of it in ways that are unfathomable.
Well, having talked about literature, I'm going to take us back to philosophy for question four. What do you hope for from philosophy in the next 20 years?
Well, see, I think it's a very exciting time to be doing philosophy because, I mean, I don't know if many of my colleagues will agree with this exactly, but the reason I think it's a wonderful time to be doing philosophy is because for several years now, and it still continues, at least in American universities, I suspect in English-speaking universities generally, the social sciences have abdicated the value-oriented aspects of their disciplines. It's improved a little bit, but this has been by and large true for almost half a century. And I think it is really a very exciting thing that philosophy might pick up that slack. And, you know, what the social sciences have abdicated. But that means philosophy has to be very much more continuous with politics, political science, political philosophy, political economy, sociology, anthropology. And you have to know much more than philosophy in order to be able to seize this kind of exciting possibility. And I very much hope that happens. I think it's already begun to happen a little bit. It does mean not just doing ideal theory. It does mean not just studying Rawls, but instead of Rawls, studying Keynes, say. You know, after all, Rawls was in some ways consolidating the New Deal and its outlook and its ideology. But I think he was doing it through ideal philosophy. But if you look at Keynes, he actually was telling you about policies that the New Deal adopted and social democracy adopted all over Europe about constraints put on capital. And I think one can't really do philosophy in the sense that I'm thinking it might be very exciting and to pick up the slack of the social sciences, you might have to know quite a lot of actual politics and political economy.
I think I'm hopeful too, in a way, on exactly those lines about the ways in which philosophy is becoming more engaged with sort of social thinking and sort of social theory, and those lines are sort of blurring, and philosophers are sort of recovering work from, for instance, the sort of Frankfurt School tradition is just much more a normal thing to be talking about in an analytic philosophy department for me now than it was at all when I was in graduate school. I guess there's a kind of fear alongside that it's all happening too late, and that, you know, that the kind of urgency of the kind of fascist resurgence that you mentioned earlier on, it's just not in the time frame in which philosophy is really going to be able to sort of create the new ideas and sort of spread the new ideas that might enable a kind of critical response to that.
I think you may be right. That's probably right, actually. That makes me very anxious.
Well, it's a natural transition to question five, then, which we maybe have begun to address. This is another Iris Murdoch-inspired question, beginning with a quote. "It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher," she wrote. "What is he afraid of?" So what are you afraid of?
Well, that's not fair. She says, what is he afraid of? And you're saying, what are you afraid of? Aren't you changing the perspective?
it's true that she, yes, exactly. It's unfair to shift from analyzing someone else to asking someone to take this third person perspective on themselves, which is not easy to do.
Exactly. No, it's a completely different thing to switch the perspective. But still, I didn't mean that by way of ducking it. You know, this is a very personal kind of question. And here my personal anxieties, I guess, shade into my anxieties for my philosophical reflection and thinking. You see, I'm an Indian, as you might know, and I feel very strongly Indian. You know, I grew up in a very Anglo home, and I think a lot of my life has been a reaction to that home. And I feel very strongly rooted in India, especially since my college days. I went to a very English, very Anglo high school, but in college I became completely, as it were, indigenous, not just in my thinking, but in my understanding of my life in that country. And yet I'm here, and I've been here for over four decades, and I really feel very anxious about a complete deracination. And, you know, much of the philosophy I do, I couldn't do in India. I mean, I could, I suppose, now that books and journals and all are available easily anywhere. But it just isn't the right ethos for doing serious work in philosophy in the universities there, I feel. So I'm stuck here. And I've got family here, my wife and daughter are here. So I feel very, very anxious about deracination. And it takes a lot of cunning to be an immigrant and domiciled here. How much to adapt, how much not to adapt and not lose one's roots. These are things that matter to me a lot, and that's why I've become very fascinated in Gandhi's philosophy. But, you know, it's schizophrenic, because I've just written a small book called On the Commons, called Capital, Culture, and the Commons, and it's really about alienation. It's really a way of spelling out early Marx's ideas relative to what's going on now. And I got most of those ideas by reflection on Gandhi's thinking. And this book doesn't mention Gandhi once, you know, because, you know, nobody's interested in Gandhi in philosophy in the West. So it just didn't seem, you know, the right thing to do to make it all about Gandhi, though all of my thinking on the subject was inspired by Gandhi. So I talk about multi-person prisoner's dilemmas. I talk about alienation, early Marx, and so on and so forth, and about the tragedy of the commons, etc. But I don't talk about Gandhi at all, even though a lot of the thinking comes from there. That's a real anxiety of mine, that I'm losing, I mean, you're doing philosophy, I'm losing my sense of being tethered and moored to my country and my people and so on, which I do feel very strongly that way. It's not as if I'm alienated when I am in America or England, which are the other two places I've lived in, but I nevertheless am constantly dreading that I'll just become a deraciné.
It is really interesting to hear how that cultural experience of immigration sort of interacts with your intellectual experience of being of sort of the intellectual gulf between philosophy and other analytic philosophy and other kinds of traditions. I know at some point you were planning to write a book that was going to be about Gandhi. I think you wrote an essay about Gandhi as philosopher that was really wonderful. Is that book still forthcoming?
My dear fellow, it's 1,440 pages at this moment on my daughter's rude count of the pages. So it's very much coming. It just has to start. And I may have to bring it out in two volumes, but I've been working on it for quite some time. And, you know, it's a very ambitious book because it's not just philosophy. It's about history. It's about the freedom movement in India. But it's all through a philosophical lens. So it is primarily a philosophical book. And I'm on sabbatical next year, so I'll try and cut it quite a lot and then send it to the press.
That is exciting to hear. And it's a happy note on which to end. And for me to say thank you, Akhil, for appearing on the podcast.
Very nice to talk to you, Karen.
Akhil Belgrami is the Sydney Morgan Besser Professor of Philosophy at Columbia University. He's the author of Belief and Meaning, Self-Knowledge and Resentment, and Secularism, Identity and Enchantment. Thanks for listening to Five Questions.